Nerdette is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. Join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic HBO original limited series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by Hacia, whose Executive Fellows Program provides Black and Latinx business owners with real-world tools and strategies needed to master fundamental management concepts related to company stability and growth. Registrants learn through one-on-one executive coaching sessions with subject matter experts in the areas of finance, business development, operations, and legal. More info at haciaworks.org.
From WBEZ Chicago, this is Nerdette. I'm Greta Johnson. We did it. We made it to another weekend. Coming up, we are going to hear from the author of a novel that imagines a world where the federal government offers cash reparations to the descendants of enslaved people.
A lot of the conversation when you're talking about the racial wealth gap, it gets stuck in these places that we can't seem to get beyond. And so I wanted the book to largely be about what happens after.
But first, it is our chance to sit back and relax from the week that was with two excellent humans. With us this week, we have the senior producer of WBEZ's daily talk show, Reset, Meha Ahmad. Meha, hello.
Hey, Greta.
Yay. Also here is Araceli Gomez-Aldana, a John S. Knight Fellow and journalist. Araceli, hello.
Good morning. How's it going?
Good morning. Okay, so we have to start with Taylor Swift. Her newest album, The Tortured Poets Department, is out today. Are y'all going to listen? Meha, I feel like you just always have such strong opinions that I am kind of excited to talk to you about this one. I have no idea what you're going to say, but I can't wait.
It's funny because like my I do have a strong opinion, but it's a very like non-opinion. Mm. Is that like I just don't care.
Ooh, but I like that.
But I don't like dislike Taylor Swift.
Right. You just don't care.
I mean, I don't get the craze, but also think I may be somewhat out of the demographic for it.
Sure, so, sure.
I mean, I guess I'll catch what makes it to TikTok and Instagram.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to actively look for the album. Sorry, Swifties.
You're opting out of the discourse. No, it's okay. What about you, Araceli?
I'm a little bit on the same boat. I like to listen to music as it comes to me. So, like, I will just let music, you know, appear on my phone and I will listen to it. I'm not going to search for new music,
sure.
I guess. So yeah, if there's a song that's catchy, I'll probably hear it on TikTok. And if there's any, you know what I'm into? I'm into like all the like secret stuff she puts into her song. So like,
yes.
I'm here for the tea when it comes to her music. So I want to know who she's talking about and all that. And that comes to me just on social media. So I don't have to search for that either. Like it just washes over me and I just accept it.
It's all organic. I love that. So yeah, more broadly, there was a great article in The Cut this week that was about how friendships have broken up because of love for or hatred of Taylor Swift. I like to call them Swifty Rifties because I'm punny like that. But it did get us wondering if there were celebrities for whom you would like get in a fight. And Meha, this is another one where it's like, I can't wait to hear what your answer is for this one.
When you had mentioned this to us, Greta, like my initial reaction was that is so stupid that they would fight over this and like break up a friendship. But then like it was a real moment of self-awareness because I did come from the boy band era. That was like I grew up in the thick of that.
Yeah.
And you know, I was a big NSYNC fan. Still am a big NSYNC fan. If anybody else, you guys are also close to my age, you remember like NSYNC fans could not be friends with BSB fans.
Mm.
And then like
nobody
talked to 98 Degree fans. So, I mean, like those debates got pretty heated, you know, like if your band made it to the top of TRL, you know, Total Request Live, you would the next day go to school and be like, in your face. Like you had a bit of an attitude. So like, I can't say that I don't fully relate.
Sure.
Cause I'm like, cause you know, I did grow up with that.
Yeah.
But I can't say that I ever stopped being friends with someone over that. Like it was more like a funny fight. Like we fought, but underneath we knew we were joking.
Yeah.
Which this does not feel like that. This feels like
no. If
you reject Taylor Swift, you're rejecting me.
Yes.
And my experience and my heartache and my grief. And that is something that is harder for me to grasp because I'm like, oh, if that's what it is, I can somewhat understand where you're coming from, but I also don't know how you got to that place, like where you connected. Taylor Swift is your experience and is your journey.
It's a really complicated one because I completely, like, there is nothing more beautiful than feeling seen in someone's art, right? And like really being able to like connect with that so fully is gorgeous. However, I do think it's also deeply problematic to like to connect that strongly with someone who you just don't actually know, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking. I was thinking, you know, with me, it was like the Christina Britney thing, like you had to pick for some reason. And I just remember thinking like, yeah, I liked Christina Aguilera and I liked Britney, and anything that I would consume was like from a magazine or from an interview I saw on TV. But like now we know so much about everything about, you know, celebrities that it is kind of like, you know, you either know everything or you don't know anything almost. Like it's so strange. And that's why it's so kind of like you can't be in the middle. Like you have to pick one.
Yeah. 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 It's fascinating. Yeah. It was funny talking about it because as we were preparing for this, like the Nerdette team ended up in like a very philosophical conversation about like, is this what's wrong with America? Is that we're just like picking sides too hard? And like, how dare you if you can't agree? But it gets so complicated.
I read something that was like, we have become so isolated and have not developed, you know, our deep and regular friendships that celebrities have become more so than ever before, the placeholders for those relationships. So we become very attached to them in ways that we should be attached to, like,
actual
real life
humans.
Yeah. A real person.
Right. And so, like, that's why you get sort of, like, these very tense, if you hate this person, it's like you hate me.
Yeah.
And it's really, it's just so, I find it, like, people love and fangirl, whoever you like.
Right.
At the same time, Taylor Swift ain't going to love you back in that way.
Yeah.
And, you know, be really, I feel like this is so obvious, but, like, be really careful about ditching the real life people in your life.
Yes.
Because they don't like the album that you are crying over. I just feel like.
Yeah.
You know, there are, you know, so yes, maybe to your point, is this what's wrong with America? I mean, I think it's what's wrong with, because this is a global thing too, right? Like,
true.
It's what's wrong with celebrity culture, but it's also what's wrong with this sort of isolated, I don't even know what the word for it is, but just sort of this isolation, I guess, this loneliness that people have.
And also what happens when they fall? Because
yes.
I feel like, you know, we've seen it. We've seen these huge celebrities and artists kind of come tumbling down. And then if your identity is tied up in that, I'm worried about you.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really rough. It's really interesting. rough. Okay. That's going to be my transition. I hate it, but we're doing it.
I thought that was intentional and I was like, smart.
Okay. So another story that caught our attention this week was about Bark Air, which is apparently the first ever chartered airline service for dogs. Now, Bark is the company that owns like BarkBox, which is, you know, like the subscription, like treat and toy thing. They are partnering with a charter jetline so that people can travel with their dogs. Of course, it is not cheap. A one-way ticket is $6,000. I kind of feel like we can't not play burden or delight with this one. Like, is this a burden or is it a delight? What do you think, Araceli?
I love this story. I went and spent way too much time on the frequently asked questions on this website because I don't know if you guys saw, they are from the dog's perspective. Like, amazing. So like one of them is like, are there size or breed restriction for dogs that can fly? And then the answer is, I can't believe you would ask this. Stop breed shaming.
Oh my
God. Welcome dogs of all sizes and breeds. In fact, oversized dogs, snubs, nose dogs, and all the other dogs out there who have never had an opportunity to fly, you are our VIPs, very important pups.
Oh, my God.
Okay, so love it.
Amazing.
This would be probably my nightmare, though, to fly.
Yes.
Like, I don't know. I just, there's so many things I can't control.
Yes.
So
yes.
I'm going to say a huge burden for me.
Yeah.
But if you have a dog, I think this is great, right?
Bark Air now. It feels like a burden because of the price point.
Yes.
I dig the idea, right? Like, I want dogs to be comfortable on flights. It is, but the cost is a burden for now, but it's because it's such a, it's not going to a lot of places. It's only like a few cities it's small. I think if it were to grow and expand and they were able to bring that price point down, absolute delight.
But what happens if they fight? What happens if the dogs fight? Or what happens if like, if there's a bunch of messes?
I know that's how it sounds like you would just be trapped in a plane with like a lot of, to your point, Araceli, like just very unpredictable potential catastrophes. But Matt, I could picture you enjoying being on a plane surrounded by dogs and just being like, this is what's happening.
I just want to play with puppies. Why won't people let me have this thing? I'm still fighting for a bring your dog to work day. People are fighting me on that one. But I just want to play with pups.
Yeah.
I think that, I mean, my assumption is that the staff, I feel like the company will have already thought about a lot of those things. And
for sure.
I would hope that they have thought of like a protocol to, if there were messes or whatever, that they would fix that. So I'm not going to worry about, that's not my job to worry about that. My job is to think about dogs and playing and stuff.
they give you like a cleaning kit. They give you a cleaning kit. Cute. If something happens.
Nice.
I was going to say, they did, like, I saw some of the notes that it was like they give them things to calm them.
That's smart.
Including
yeah.
like a calming jacket or whatever. So I'm getting like very chill vibes from Bark Air.
Okay. All right. We'll see what happens. So finally, I want to talk about the women's track and field uniforms that Nike just released for the U.S. team to wear for the Summer Olympics. One of them is pretty much a swimsuit with like really high cut legs. It does have a modest neckline, but a lot of people have criticized it for trying to make female athletes look sexy. Of course, this is not necessarily a new story. Nike has responded to the criticism in an email to NPR, and they said that it is just one of many options for women on Team USA and that they are taking female comfort seriously. I kind of feel like this is a story that comes up every 4 years. I wish it weren't still a thing, but it seems like it just will be forever. Araceli, had this one crossed your radar before I sent you a link to it?
Yeah, I had heard a lot of things about, especially like Nike, like even in the article it mentioned like some of the things that have been going on with the baseball jerseys and just like a lot of stuff that's like on Nike's back right now. But when I saw the image that the article kind of showed, I thought it was like, I know Nike's joking. Like is this something where like they want it to be bad so that we all talk about it or something? Cause I'm like, there is no person that would look at that and be like, yeah, that looks real great for the female athletes that are going to be wearing it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I mean, I sent a video to Mahal yesterday and I was like, I can't believe this. Like this is like someone going through and being like, what is going on with these things? And
the comments were amazing.
Yeah. The comments were amazing. But like, it really is like, who designed it? Like, that's kind of like, that person should step forward. I want to talk to that person.
I mean, it's giving only men were in the room to help design this.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which I don't know if it was, but it feels like, I just can't imagine a woman looking at this uniform and being like, yep, that'll cover me. That I can run in that comfortably. I don't know people that could stand in this comfortably, let alone run and do sports in this.
No, the wedgies.
It's too high of a cut. If you zoom in on the picture, the mannequin that is wearing this uniform has a camel toe. It is a mannequin. Like, how did they do that? They had to try. So I'm almost like, Araceli, I hear what you're saying about, I wonder if they did this on purpose to get us talking about it.
Mm.
Like, because I'm like, oh, that would make sense. Because nothing else up until now made sense to me. Like, yeah, they raised the neckline, but they also raised the bikini line. Like,
right.
It's giving Baywatch. Remember, like the high cut?
Yes.
It was like so uncomfortable for those actors. Like, that's what this looks like.
Yeah. I just didn't even get the neckline thing. I'm like, who's looking at the neckline? I'm literally looking at this mannequin suffering as we speak.
This could be a turtleneck and nobody would notice because we're all looking at the veg.
Yes.
Like, that's what's going on here.
At the hip bones that are fully exposed because of this weird swimsuit.
And funny because it's next to the men's uniform, which is like decent shorts.
Yes, they are decent shorts. I mean, it's so frustrating because it's just like, I do think it's one of, and you know, I don't even follow sports really at all. Like, I'm not going to watch the Olympics, but it does, I think, especially when it comes to female athletes, it's just like, when are we going to be taken seriously? You know?
Mm-hmm.
It's wild.
And I do think about a lot, like the other uniforms as well. Like, obviously, like gymnastics is like you have to be aerodynamic and everything.
Right.
But then even like the it is like a costume. Like the figure skating is like a costume. Yes. Like to me, it's like, you know, why don't we focus on the athletic part instead of like,
yeah,
you know, making it seem like, you know, these women, you know, most of them are women, like
right.
to be just put in these, you know, outfits. Like, come on. If it was actually efficient and like people like could really run faster in this, then the men would be wearing it. Like
right.
100%. So
now I'm picturing a dude in one of those.
Can you? Yeah. Can you imagine?
Oh my gosh. So speaking of women's athletics, were either of you invested in the WNBA draft this week? I was not, but it seemed like people were really excited about it.
Number one fan.
I'm
so invested. Yeah, I'm looking at season tickets as we speak.
Are you really?
Oh my gosh. Like I'm literally about to buy season tickets for Chicago Sky. Yes, 100%. I'm so excited for the new drafts. Like they are perfect for Chicago. I think we need to embrace them. The city needs to embrace them. Like I'm excited. Yeah, can't wait. I can't wait.
Oh, that's awesome. What about you, Meha? Did you follow it?
I followed it because I saw a lot of buzz.
Yeah, on social media. It was very buzzy this year.
So I'm like I jumped on the bandwagon kind of person.
Yeah.
But I will say, like, I've been to a Sky game. They're really exciting. But I am so excited about this season as, like, a fair weather fan a bit. It just seemed like everything – WNBA totally is leveling up in a way we hadn't seen before. And – but here's the thing. Those Sky tickets were, like, pretty affordable before. Mm. And now I'm seeing, like, really high prices. And I'm like, oh, my God, can I afford to go this season? I'm super excited for Chicago and Chicago Sky. I'm not excited for my bank account. Because I'm going to go either way. I'm just going to be upset I had to pay so much.
I'm so excited. I think we all should go to a game. All of us. Let's all go.
Well, Meha, I was just going to say, I mean, sounds like you have a friend who's about to buy some season tickets. So
that's
maybe
right.
You can
yes.
get in on that. Exactly.
Take your friend Meha with you, please.
Exactly.
100%.
Well, Meha, Araceli, thank you both very much for coming on. It was a real treat to have you.
Thanks so much for having us.
I love Nerdette.
Love Nerdette for life.
Love you guys.
In just a minute, we are going to talk about a novel that envisions what cash reparations could look like in the United States.
Nerdette is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. Join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic HBO original limited series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Our next guest is Maura Cheeks. She is the author of a recent book called Acts of Forgiveness, and it's a very thought-provoking novel that imagines a world where the President of the United States enacts a federal reparations policy called the Forgiveness Act. With this new law, each qualifying descendant of an enslaved person could get $175,000. The book follows Willie, a black woman whose family's economic precarity forced her to prioritize their needs over her own career aspirations. And that's all I'm going to say for now, because I want to try to keep this as spoiler-free as possible. But Maura, welcome to Nerdette.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for coming on. I think this book is just such a fascinating thought experiment. I'd love to hear how it came to be.
Yeah, I was working on an article for The Atlantic. I won a reporting fellowship with them to write about the racial wealth gap. And, you know, I finished writing it and was still sort of struggling with a lot of questions that came up through my research about these structural inequalities that really result in, you know, the average white family having about six times more wealth than the average black family, and sort of like our inability to enact some of these policies that have been suggested. And so fiction started to feel like a better way to explore some of those questions. Mm-hmm. You know, I think a lot of the conversation when you're talking about the racial wealth gap, it gets stuck in these places that we can't seem to get beyond. Right. And so I wanted the book to largely be about what happens after reparations is already passed, so that we can get into what it is like for one family.
Mm. it's something fiction can do, right? Where it's sort of like, oh yeah, let's follow this thread and see what it would be like. There really is something just magical about that, you know?
Yeah, it was an interesting experience writing fiction because I hadn't really done it, but I love it. I've always loved reading fiction. And so the process mm-hmm. of writing it was intense, but fun.
That's interesting. I love reading fiction too, but I always think like, oh no, I'm not actually, like, I'm just a reader of it. I'm not a writer. Like, did you have to kind of give yourself permission to be like,
maybe
no, I can
I'm
write
just
a
delusional.
Novel.
No, I've always read books and been like, well, I can do this.
That's amazing. I love it. No, we call that confident. I thought this book was a really interesting balance of like optimism and realism. Because, you know, I mean, on the one hand, as you know, like the Forgiveness Act passes in this book. It's so exciting for so many people in the story, but it's not all perfect, right? Like, of course, there is still like intense governmental bureaucracy requiring rigorous documentation to prove that these people are the descendants of enslaved people, which of course is like super scarce and puts so much of like the burden of proof on these people who have already been oppressed.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I wanted to explore what it would actually be like, and it wouldn't be all sunny and roses. So I explore on the one hand, the different various reactions to the bill, which mm-hmm. I think and I hope would mimic sort of some of the reactions if it were to pass in real life, which is to say that, you know, some people are really for it, but they have reservations about doing the work to provide the necessary documents. And then there's some people who are, obviously against it. And then there's a lot of gray in the middle, right? Of just, the inability or the lack of desire to dig up the past and what looking backward really means. The sort of hesitation to do so.
So we've mentioned Willie very briefly. I said that her family is in like an economically precarious position, but that is largely because of what you are talking about in terms of the original reporting you had done around wealth gap and the fact that it's her grandfather, right, who is rejected from getting a home through the GI Bill.
That's right.
And, you know, I mean, I think it speaks so perfectly to, you know, that idea of like the very real generational impact of systemic racism in this country. You know, I mean, so many people are like, oh, slavery was, you know, it was a really long time ago. But like, that's a fallacy in and of itself, isn't it?
Yeah. And I wanted to show how, we're not that far removed from it. And the book starts with her grandfather being denied benefits from the GI Bill. And for me, that scene really comes from this desire to show how systemic decisions really play out in real life through these very sort of smaller moments, right? Of like, if he had just been granted mortgage assistance, what that might mean for her family. And so, you know, it's both like largely structural, but it plays out in very sort of everyday ways.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever envision this book as just being about like a big apology, but not literal dollars at play?
No, it was important for me to be about the money because I think that is true. I mean, it's complicated, but it's about the money, but it's not about the money, which is a sort of a nuance that I try to explore.
For sure.
Yeah, so for me, it had to be about
dollars,
about giving actual money to people. Yeah.
How did you settle on $175,000?
That number comes from research that I did. I spoke with a professor pretty extensively named his name is Sandy Darity, and he wrote a book with his wife called From Here to Equality. And in that book, they outline pretty detailed plans for how a federal reparations program could work and what that number would look like. So 175 isn't in their book, but it's taken from sort of some of the suggested ways they could get to that number. One of those being, you know, the amount that it would actually take to close the racial wealth gap or to give Black people in America the proportion of wealth that's in line with the proportion of Black Americans in the country.
And given your research, is that that is a thing the federal government could afford to do if it were interested in prioritizing that?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the PPP relief during the pandemic, right? We know that the government can come up with the money.
Yeah, it's interesting to think we do have precedent, like very recent precedent now of like them just handing out cash to people, you know?
Right. On very short notice, right? Of like there's an emergency and there's funds available. And so they could do it. It's, it could look very, you know, it could come to life in a variety of ways. And I think, you know, what they explore in From Here to Equality is also that it's not necessarily the case where one check would be written and you would give out a lump sum of $175,000. Like I say in my book, that doesn't necessarily have to be how it would be implemented. It could be over the course of, you know, 5 or 10 years, families could receive money. Yeah.
It seems like, at least from recent reporting that I've been seeing, that this seems reparations, cash reparations, seems like, at least at the federal level, that it's still more or less a non-starter.
Yes, unfortunately, that seems to be the case.
So what to you, like, what is the next step that you would find promising when it comes to this issue?
Well, I'll preface it by saying I'm not a policy expert. I write
Fair
fiction.
Enough. Yes. Yes. But, you wrote a really interesting novel about the impact of policy, and now I'm putting you in this position.
But no, I mean, I am hopeful by, you know, and energized by the local policies that are passing. So I also wrote about that a little bit in the New York Times piece. But, you know, in Evanston, they're doing really great work.
Yeah, it's super close to Chicago.
That's encouraging. And then I think on the federal level, you know, passing H.R. 40, I think, would be a great first step, which is just saying we're going to study how, you know, segregation and the impact of slavery has actually impacted the country and has contributed to the racial wealth gap, and put forth proposals of what reparations on a federal level could look like.
For sure. What has feedback been like to the book?
It's been great. It's been really positive and a fun experience. I was nervous releasing a book about reparations.
Sure.
Especially, you know, during an election year, during, you know, I'm not going to name names, but, I was nervous just given the political climate, but I think it speaks
to... It is a climate.
To, I think it speaks to... yeah, just the way that the conversation has evolved. Mm-hmm. I think, I mean, even in 2019, when I first started writing the book, if you said reparations, people really didn't understand what that meant.
Yeah.
A lot depends, I think, on this next election.
I really didn't want to talk about the election today, Maura.
I'm sorry.
No, don't apologize.
I think that will obviously influence the conversation, at least on a federal level. I think locally, people and local governments can continue doing great work.
Well, thank you so much for coming on and for sharing this book with the world.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, that's it for this week. Thank you, as always, for listening along. We are on for Beautyland Book Club. We are taping that late next week. So your deadline for voicemails about Beautyland is April 25th. We would love to hear what you think about this one, so send those in. You know the drill. Just record yourself on your smartphone and then email the audio file to nerdatpodcast@gmail.com. We also are still collecting voicemails from you about how much Nerdat means to you. We would love to hear from you for that one as well. Same deal. That email address is nerdatpodcast@gmail.com. We love you all. Thank you for chiming in. Nerdat is produced by me and Anna Bauman at WBEZ in Chicago and is part of the NPR network. And our executive producer is Brendan Banaszak. We will see you next week.
Wait, I was going to say that if there was going to be a celebrity that I fight over, it's going to be you, Greta. If somebody doesn't like you, we can't be friends. Silly. Like, so...
We will roll up for Greta Johnson.
Oh my gosh, y'all are going to make me cry. That's too sweet.
Nerdette is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. Join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic HBO original limited series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.